This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 5th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 161, with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
On this week's show, we'll be joined by a renowned documentary director offering his alternative take on London's richly storied past, Julian Temple.
We'll chat with Hilary Powell, co-editor of a new book, The Art of Dissent, who'll tell us why she does not believe the Olympics are a cause for celebration.
And we'll be talking to Charles Atlas, the filmmaker whose work blurs the lines between choreography, design and spectacle.
I thought there was some bodybuilding in there as well, Andrew.
There's a little bit of bodybuilding too.
All that plus a look ahead to next week's biggest stories right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's the big O. He's in town. He's still in town.
Who's still? The Olympics?
Yeah.
Is it a he? I think it's a bit sexist, Rob. It may be a she.
I don't know. It's just the way he was standing.
Okay. It's in town. The big O's here. Yesterday I went to see my first thing at the Olympics.
What was that?
I went to see some athletics, and I'm going to see some more tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Do you feel that the Olympics have sort of fallen into its stride now? We're in the main arena now that people are running, jumping, throwing things.
Yeah, somebody did say at the weekend in a newspaper, the games have now finally begun.
Oh, are you suggesting I've stolen that from it?
No, but I'm saying it's interesting.
It's hardly an original.
The people think that running is actually the bit where it really begins, whereas splashing about in the pool is kind of having fun. But, you know, that's for kids, really, with their water wings. This is the real men's stuff.
I think you're right. I was speaking to Monocle's senior editor, Sophie Grove, and she was saying, I'm a bit fed up with swimming now. We're all sort of like day seven of just like constant underwater shots of like sort of men and women tadpoling around.
Yeah, she is a woman who will get into bikini for the merest hint of water.
I know. You wouldn't want to speak ill of people without them actually being here, but I think there are no beaches in Switzerland.
No,
but
I've often said to her, at least put your top on, love.
Oh dear, it's got to that point already, and we're only at the introduction, Andrew Tuck.
Okay, I'm just telling you, that's the kind of woman she's like.
It's episode 161 of the Monocle Weekly. It's a while since we've done a show together.
I know, it feels...
We did a Midori House.
And it feels so good.
Maybe they'll play that song later on.
I think that could be our theme tune.
From your rendition of it, I couldn't quite recognise the song, but I'm sure through Shazam or some other amazing internet invention, they'll find out what that was.
I think Shazam might struggle as well.
And we're going to, talking of which, speaking of the devil, I think we've got a new section, haven't we?
We've got a new section. Every week we're going to... this show kind of looks ahead at the week ahead. That's the theme.
Without a hint of tautology.
But we don't always quite do that, but we're going to make sure we do now. Every week we're going to have the agenda, which is going to be... We're going to get editors from the Monocle floor to come down and look at the week ahead.
And do I have to do that?
You have to quiz them.
All right.
And now we can reveal that actually...
What's in your diary, Rob? Well...
We can reveal that one of them, who is the one who's quite fond of like flipping off her clothes at the merest hint of water, is actually in the room.
Trying to remain repost from that.
What a reveal. That's theatrical. I feel like there should be a proscenium arch in here rather than a studio ceiling. Hi, Sophie.
Hello, chaps. I'm fully clothed. I've got my bikini upstairs.
I did turn the heating up in the studio, but nothing's happened yet. What's the agenda?
Hold on. We should introduce the other one, because there's another one here who, again, just see a bit of water and his pants are off. Tom Edwards is here.
Hello, I'm here and I'm fully clothed, just so no one worries.
So I think the leading question, Sophie and Tom, is what's in your crystal balls this week? We're going to start with Sophie.
I'm interested in what's happening around the Olympics, because we're all focusing on the Olympians themselves and all their jumping and running, but actually there's a lot of diplomacy going on around the scenes. There are thousands of dignitaries in London, And there's even
dignitaries.
I like dignitaries. There's even the Foreign Office have even set up a special dignitary management team that are based in Canary Wharf. Their sole objective is trying to sort of manage all these people who are streaming in and out. They're not actually telling the Foreign Office really when they're coming. They're sort of lots of them are sort of throwing these surprise visits. And the most hotly debated arrival or sort of no-show is Obama. People think he might come to the closing ceremony, which is going to be next week on the 12th. There are actually going to be about 98 other dignitaries and sort of heads of state.
About 98?
Well, that's what they said to me at the Foreign Office.
Nice round number. That's a very Foreign Office speak.
It does sound a little bit like that. But it's so fascinating to watch the bilateral meetings that are going on. Apparently, William Hague had about 6 or 7 just in and around the opening ceremony. But it's also interesting that Cameron has our Prime Minister, David Cameron, in the UK, has actually scheduled a conference on hunger, which is going to kick off exactly after the opening ceremony finishes. And that's just going to be bringing a lot of NGOs, world leaders, anyone that happens to be here for the sport is going to be pulled in
Kind of kidnapping of a lot of kind of airtime and capital off the back of the closing ceremony. And
exactly.
Who's going to be here?
It is very clever. There's also next week, and it has been happening this week, a summit on global business, which is all aimed at trying to attract business into the UK. And that they're actually trying to really offset the billions that they've spent on investing in the Olympics within inward investment into the UK. And apparently there have been about 3,000 sort of top business people coming in, and they've been sort of getting them into UKTI, getting them into the Foreign Office and into Number 10. And then off the back of that, they've already had a big meeting and a summit with Christine Lagarde and the head of the World Bank attended too. So she was the head of the IMF.
You can't move for dignitaries, Andrew, basically, is what Sophie's saying.
Do you think
this is a super dignitary? Is Barack Obama still the super dignitary, the uber dignitary?
Yes, I think so. Do you think they all act with dignity? Is that it must be the same stem of the word, mustn't it? I'm not sure they are very dignified.
Well, it depends who they are. I mean, it's interesting to see Putin, who was here last week, and there was this sort of Russian judo diplomacy that went on, and David Cameron took him to watch a judo match, and apparently they're discussing Syria at the same time. He was acting with dignity. It's his first trip to the UK for 7 years, and then there was a huge falling out over the Litvinenko case, where there was Kremlin critic poisoned in the UK, and it's a really interesting moment to see sport as a focus for this dignitary and a sort of pariah in terms of the UK policies.
It's also like a scene from like an Oliver Stone movie, like two world leaders kind of discussing the sort of future of a kind of failed state while watching, well, maybe it would be a baseball match if it was an Oliver Stone movie, but it's a kind of weird particular thing. And you hope that they were talking about Syria rather than sort of making small talk over peanuts, do you know what I mean, at the judo. Thank you, Sophie.
And should we go from the political arena to the sporting arena?
Let's go over to Tony Cork with all the sport.
I should say, by the way, that I attended a basketball game at the Olympic Park last week.
Yeah.
And I was sitting but a stone's throw from Michelle Obama herself.
I quite fancy Michelle Obama.
Well, she certainly slapped all the winning Americans on the rump after the game. Each one.
Did she really?
Individually.
That's very familiar.
Well, she embraced everyone.
Did they bend over?
She did a little rump. Well, they were quite tall. They had to stoop.
Okay. She's a very tall lady.
She's statuesque, but these guys are pituitary cases.
And Michael Phelps revealed that her husband had telephoned. Obama phoned Michael up to say,
I think you got your tenses wrong there. I think you suggested that Michael Phelps was a woman.
I didn't say he was a woman. What did I say?
It was a proper pronouns.
Okay. Oh, God. Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Michelle Phelps. It's all getting very confusing. Anyway, he phoned. He said, hello, well done.
Well, and maybe it was just the promise of that call that finally encouraged Phelps to win.
So what's going to happen in the world of sport this week?
Well, there's a few particular highlights that I'd like to draw everyone's attention to. So on Tuesday, the 7th, the triathlon. This could be another 1-2 for Great Britain, and I'm going to be quite parochial about this.
Yeah.
And encourage our brave boys. We've got a team of brothers who could win gold and silver. What a wonderful moment that would
us
be.
Us brothers, our merry band as brothers.
Absolutely.
Do you think that the speech on the eve of St. Crispian's Day will be used in the style of Henry V to rouse this triathlon team?
Invariably.
Good.
And then just tell us, I presume there's going to be a lot of Brazilians around.
Oh, dear, so many. Well, this is all...
What do you mean? What are you waving around to attract them? It's like flypaper.
This is building up, of course, to the closing ceremony on Sunday the 12th, where historically the next games inherits the flame from the current host. So the flame here will be extinguished and Rio 2016 will take up the mantle. And what a show they will be putting on in Rio. It may even surpass London. Can I even suggest that?
I've got a feeling it could be hot.
It'll be hot.
Hot.
There'll be kind of samba stylings.
Yeah.
And, but by next Sunday, there'll be just 1,454 days to go until it all gets underway again.
I can't wait for that giant clock. I can't wait for that giant clock to be counting down. Will they be playing... are there any odds on the Bengals' Eternal Flame playing?
I know who's here.
In what sense?
No, I know who's going to be doing some of the singing.
Oh, who?
Marissa Monche.
Oh, really?
She's in town.
She's a big favourite of yours, isn't she?
Yeah, I like her a lot.
Maybe we can dust off one of her tracks to play later in the show.
She's definitely going to be there.
Wow, that's a scoop, Andrew.
Yeah, I heard that.
There'll also be, of course, a Symphony of British Music. That's the title of Sunday's evening entertainment. And there'll be The Who.
The Who?
God, no one's done that joke since literally 1967. Anyway, we've got to leave it there. How do you think the new section went, guys?
I'm proud of it.
Okay, good. And Sophie Grove and Tom Edwards, news editor and our senior editor. Thank you very much for joining us on this new section of the Monocle Weekly. Coming up next, legendary film director Julian Temple talking about his new film, London Babylon. Julian Temple is one of the UK's most celebrated filmmakers, having burst onto the scene in the late 70s as crucial documentarian of the Sex Pistols' rock and roll mythology. Temple's video work has always been heavily immersed in the music world, from Sade to Scissor Sisters, but now he's diving slightly deeper, looking into the history of the city that produced so many of the artists and cultures he's made famous, London. He visited us earlier today to discuss his new film, London, Modern Babylon. Julian, thanks for joining us on The Weekly. London, the Modern Babylon... there's a lot of talking in it. There's a lot of noise in your new movie. I want to ask you about the editing process first. It's a huge cuts job. It's a kind of cacophony of stuff. I guess it was a Babylon to put together as well, right?
It was. I started in January 2011 and worked what seemed like through an endless night. At times it was like being caught in some weird sea with, instead of seaweed, these weird tentacles of film pulling you down to
sounds like a director's nightmare, an actual proper Freudian director's nightmare.
Yeah, I couldn't stop editing it in my head at night. You know, that was my big problem. But there is an energy from that. You know, there's a fear also that you can't make the film you promised you'd make at some point. But there's an energy involved of climbing out of that kind of space, which is very dark. And slowly, you just find a couple of things that kind of stick together, and you know, it's like throwing stuff like spaghetti on a wall, and some of it seems cooked, and others just bounces off, you know. And
because at the end of the film, I don't want to spoil this for people, but there is a sort of almost a postscript by yourself, which says, you know, this film was made by sort of chaos and chance, right? And it seems obviously that you're not trying to tell a history. It's not got a historical narrative as such. It's just a huge wealth, like a kaleidoscope of images, of found stuff, of archive, and of fresh stuff you've shot with sort of London luminaries like Ray Davies and people.
I hope it's kind of like a time travel rather than a history lesson. I mean, it does show 100 years of London from the beginning of film to now, and it's fueled by the music of the city, but in a way it's like a time lapse of a weird mutant triffid, you know, with
it's tentacular spectacular.
Yeah, and tentacles kind of grow and then wither and drop off, and it's just constantly in crisis and moving, but it's also unstoppable. You know, you understand that whatever London is, whatever's thrown at London, it's going to stumble back up and carry on and kind of wiser for it all.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I guess, of elements also of kind of not necessarily history repeating itself, but similar things happening. I don't exactly know whether Anarchy in the UK was you played Anarchy in the UK over the Jarrow marches, but there's certainly kind of there's elements of nice bits of chopping up of kind of playing contemporary music or 70s punk music with pieces of history, with the bombings and the war and all the rest of it, and in the First World War, there's a lot of focus on that as well. And is this a style to mix this stuff up, or is it throwing spaghetti at the wall, Julian Temple?
It's a punk epic style. I yes. think is the word for it. Yeah, it's a provocation as much as anything else. I mean, I think a city like London defies any one way of looking at it, and it would have been fatally wrong to try and impose some sentimental voiceover, you know, kind of holding it top down, clamping it down. The thing you have to do is let the archive suggest, and the voices and the ghosts suggest ways of going, and let them kind of hector you into using them in some way. I think, you know, images and are freed by music in an incredible way as well. Mm. So you can cut. By the end of it, I was into a kind of Charlie Parker groove with the editing, where everything you did seemed to make sense, whereas at the beginning yeah. nothing made sense. But by the end, I could cut a glance from a kid in 1904. To a woman on a park bench today, and get real kind of dramatic connections going, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. It's an interesting analogy to use that. I mean, I think most directors work in such a narrative way. There's such a sort of arc that they're looking for, or whatever, or certainly a strong sort of left to right, right to left sort of way of looking at film. To look at it like a jazz musician like Charlie Parker is a very kind of weird way of looking at it. And it does have that kind of idea of kind of syncopation about it, I guess, and of a collage.
Yeah, I think it's time we freed film up. I think, you know, the kind of original grammar of film is still very preponderant in the way films are made. It, you know, even though, you know, Latin American cinema is so much freer than the kind of old Hollywood reverse angle, reverse shot, you know, reaction shot, style of doing things. I think film isn't necessarily a theatrical medium. I think it is a thing of sound and images, you know, that can entertain in other ways than a kind of three-act
yeah.
play. And certainly when you look at the history of a city like London, it is cyclical. It is like tree losing its leaves and growing it again. And you kind of understand that there are rhythms there that are outside a kind of single human view of what a narrative is, you know.
And I want to ask you about some of the faces and voices that crop up a lot in the film. Malcolm McLaren and the Sex Pistols, obviously The Filth and the Fury and The Great Rock and Roll Swindle were two of your great earlier movies. They kind of seem to be voices of reason in the film. They're people that most people think of as provocateurs in your film. They're made as voices of reason. And then maybe Churchill or the Queen or Margaret Thatcher are the provocateurs in this film. Is that fair to say?
I like the world turned upside down, yeah. I mean, I learned so much from Malcolm. I spent an insane 18 months with him before a spectacular kind of implosion of our friendship. I always knew he was a visionary of some kind, you know, also many other things. But,
we'll leave that pause in, I think.
I like all the people in it. I mean, I love Churchill. I don't dislike Churchill at all. I mean, I think he did some wonderful things and some awful things, like most people.
It's funny listening to those, the group of Cockneys that you have who are speaking over their formica table and their cups of tea, who kind of intercut through the team, through the film.
Yeah.
I've never heard that Churchill bashing song that they sang at the end of the war when Churchill was voted out as the Prime Minister and Attlee was voted
vote,
in.
Vote for Mr. Attlee.
Yeah.
It could have been a Kink song, actually.
It sad. I think that was exactly. That's a thing. Yeah. You're going to have to go and re-edit it now. You realise?
Yeah, I've got to re-release it with that £1 fish guy singing it, maybe.
Yeah, the £1 fish guy. And this is another man. This is a guy, an Asian guy, who's down. Which market?
That's Upton Park.
Okay.
Seriously peripheral. But yeah. That's where the action is these days.
And he's out east, and yeah. He's got this amazing fish song. That sounds like something that should have been, and I think there's an image of him intercut with a man with a bowler hat with a fish walking off at the end, near the end of the movie as well. It's just the idea that you can't escape London's ghost, that an Asian guy in West Ham...
That's a London street cry, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like you would have heard Jewish variations of that in 1895 in Petticoat Lane.
Yeah.
So, it just constantly... You know, it's a cliche, but it changes and changes and changes, but it also doesn't, it remains the same in a weird way. London has such a strong spirit as a city, I think, that it's always there, and people who come here become Londoners, strangely. You know, I think many other cities don't let people become part of that city in the same way that London does with people from all over the world, which is its great energy and its source of its creativity. You know, I think everyone's looking at London because of the Olympics, but the creativity of this city has always been staggering to the rest of the world. It's why the Kinks and the Stones, you know, blew the world away in the 60s. It's why, you know, you see Sid lives in Valparaiso on the wall, you know. And everywhere I go, I see Sid lives, bizarrely. If I don't see it, I have to do it myself.
That's a conspiracy theory that needs investigation. I feel another film coming on. And you said that. It was, I think Ray Davies talks about it with the sort of Windrush generation very much. Ray Davies is talking about that and how that music, the calypso music and the reggae and whatever, the roots music that was coming over with those boats, sort of informed a lot of his songwriting as well. Is that a part of it, the fact that, you know, everyone becomes a Londoner, but everyone that's a Londoner was a Londoner before gets a little bit more foreign, a little bit more interesting as well?
I think definitely, you know, the Jamaican input into London was key to the city we live in now. I mean, you just hear that calypso music and you know that vibe has been transmuted into the DNA of London, and London takes place on the street in a way it never did before. You know, Londoners walk in a different way. There's a different body language because of that Jamaican presence. And they had a very hard time at the beginning, but they did open the way for everybody, from all over the world, people being a very important part of London, I think.
And to go back to the sort of strictures of making a film like this, which is, as I say, a sort of kaleidoscope of a lot of archive as well as newly shot stuff, what set the dates for you, Julian? Was it literally the sort of the extent of the archive that you could... you could explore?
Well, in a way, it is a film about film as well, because it begins at the dawn of film in London. The very first images of London, bizarrely, were shot by the Lumiere brothers only 3 months after they invented the camera device thing that they had. And they brought it to London, and the first thing they filmed was, bizarrely, these buskers in blackface outside the Empire Music Hall in Leicester Square, kind of pogoing around like some mad Dex's Midnight Runners or something. So I guess that was a prophetic moment. I've always loved blackface, so I was happy to begin it there.
Yeah, right. And there's a sort of, as much as there's an anti-narrative in the film almost, we do end up kind of with Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, the development of Docklands, which was all, you know, those warehouses were full of all the things they're named after, like Lyme House and all the stuff that was coming from the colonies, I
tobacco
suppose.
And wine.
Yeah.
And
that, you know. What happens at that point in the film? I mean, there is a sort of narrative, but it's a bit, it becomes a bit more didactic, perhaps, what maybe you think about London.
Yeah, that's possibly true. I mean, I think the London we live in now was very much forged in the late 80s, not just the freeing of the banks to run riot, but also, you know, the kind of regeneration idea of London where you just kick everybody out and rent it to a few oligarchs. You know, that demonising of social housing, which we really need in this city. We're not going to be able to function unless people who work here are able to live here. You know, I feel very strongly that is the decade or the time and the mindset that has has come to fruition now in our double dip recession.
And there's a lot of obsessions with the mob. In terms of last year's King Mob. And this is some, this is sort of the insight, the sort of the kind of lyrics that the Sex Pistols, you know, the wrote and incited sort of a behaviour maybe that didn't, and it comes back right back to the London riots of last year, and then straight back in history. And there was also a sort of the anti-mob, the kind of the gel of society that happened after the Blitz and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
the mob's an interesting idea, and that's carried on in voices and in readings of poetry and stuff in the in the film as well. Have you got a bit of a mob obsession?
Well, I think the mob is underrated, actually, in terms of what it's achieved.
Yeah,
you know, without the Chartists, you wouldn't have male votes. Without the suffragettes rioting and smashing shop windows, women wouldn't have the vote.
Some lovely images of ladies in frilly dresses smashing windows.
Yeah, those Edwardian girls, yeah. And you know, can't get enough of them, actually. I think we need, you know, 21st century suffragettes. But yeah, the mob, you know, I think London is in a state of crisis, perpetual crisis, which it can't resolve, but it, you know, at times the elastic band stretches too far and it snaps, and then the process can begin again. And I don't advocate violence at all, but I do think there are all kinds of violence. There's invisible everyday violence as well as, you know, banging on shop windows. And these things are responses to other things. You know, nothing happens without a causal effect. Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about, as much about the images, obviously the music's very strong. It's a very strong suit of yours, clearly. How do you narrow it down to the 100+ songs that are in the film?
Just kind of instinct, really. I mean, I quite like using songs that I don't like as well as songs that I like, if they catch a vibe.
Oh, what don't you like that's in there? Because I kept on trying. I was watching the film with the notes, trying to constantly go, oh, that was that, that was that. Lots of things are going to have to try and go and buy now.
Well, it's weird because actually you start off not liking Baker Street. I hate Baker Street, but I actually love it in the film.
Never knowingly undersaxed.
Yeah. You can learn to love what you hate. That's an important thing, not to be too fixed in anything, I think. You know, opinions are good, but other people have them too. You've got to remember that.
Well, Julian Temple, maybe we should end by asking you what you mean by just jump into the archive and drown. That's one of the points at which the film ends, and which I felt I'd sort of wholeheartedly done.
I don't recommend doing it at home. You shouldn't try it on your own.
What do you need? Do you need armbands to swim around in that archive?
You need a great, you know, kind of rescue team around you.
Julian Temple, director of London, The Modern Babylon. Thank you for joining us on The Weekly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Julian Temple and I chatting about his new film, London, Modern Babylon, earlier today.
The perfect accompaniment to summer is a well-mixed cocktail. So as the season hits its stride, we handpicked a trio of bartenders from around the world to prepare for us their cocktail du jour. From Tokyo to São Paulo via Beirut, we filmed the maestros at work, headlining the Yoshida Martini, the Lychee Caipirinha, and the Aromatic Smash. Pull up a bar stool for a front row seat. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Our next guest is an artist with a firmly real-world agenda, looking at how design and public works relate to us, the men and women in the street. Hilary Powell's new book of essays and photography, The Art of Dissent, looks at how London's scramble to create an Olympic legacy might not have the positive future impact people are celebrating today. Hilary, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello.
So let's start at the very beginning. Your work as an artist is looking at how we have this notion of creating utopias. And I think you're trying to, you know, kind of prick the balloon, as it were, and say, hold on, this isn't a utopia that's being created by the Olympic Games.
Yeah, it kind of began by living right on the doorstep of the area that now is currently the Olympic Park in East London, and very aware of the rapid kind of cleansing of the area that happened even before we won the bid. And at that point, in 2007, I made a film called The Games, which staged this surreal, like, DIY alternative Olympics on those sites before the kind of mega event came in, and questioning that kind of ideal landscape that's involved within the Olympic movement, the ideal bodies, but how that applies to the landscape and this kind of cleansing of areas considered dirty in the city, and questioning the need for the kind of juggernaut that came into that area. And I don't think I would have had this kind of urge to do this kind of work if it had not been on my doorstep. But as it was, it came out of a kind of love of a change in place and a need to document it.
And did you think that the main concern was that, you know, the local voice was being lost to the national voice, the individuals who lived in the area, they couldn't get their feelings across in this kind of huge debate that was going on?
I think, and that's very particular to the Olympics, that the Olympics is, you know, it has very great things to recommend it in terms of inspiring achievement and aspiration in sporting achievement, but I think it's easy for that to become the overriding narrative and to cast its spell and to easily allow other things to go under the carpet, and the kind of legal architecture of the games, the compulsory purchase orders that were in there, the kind of disenfranchised local voices. And so I felt that now when editing this book with Isaac Marrero, we've brought together our work and the work of 60 other artists, writers and critics, activists, just to make sure that these smaller voices don't just totally disappear, these kind of ephemeral protests, that the overarching narrative isn't the only one to be heard.
And Hilary, looking through the book, it's almost, I almost get a sense of, obviously there's paintings in here, there's essays by people like Ian Sinclair, who's a famous sort of Olympic contrarian. I get the sense it's almost like the minutes of the meeting that should have happened but never did about the Olympics. Is there that idea that you wanted to document everything that almost should have been said?
Yeah, because it was all happening on such a small scale. So I was running events that brought people together. This is all over the last maybe 10 years.
Yeah.
And so there was so much activity and so many people voicing their opinions and thoughts and in a creative way, but it would so easily get lost, I think, that and doing a book was a way of hopefully letting that travel and sustain itself and kind of write an alternative history and legacy of the games that could potentially impact on the way that future cities might approach that. Because when I was looking for, there must have been these kind of reactions in other cities, you know, in every Olympics, but there's never in you know, it's harder to find, it's lost in the kind of...
Because you always called a killjoy as well. I mean, there's a sort of, because of certain people, like people we mentioned, maybe there's always a sort of a few famous people that go, oh, it's not always cracked up to be. But there's a sense, once that now the games are afoot, that you're a terrible kind of stick in the mud if you're not kind of flying your flag. And I guess there's a different thing to supporting your national team or digging the whole idea of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And everything being kind of railroaded in order for those to happen in the first place.
Yeah, because I'm 1 mile up the road kind of watching the Olympics and feeling the buzz and excitement in the area, but the kind of strategies that are put in place to allow the Olympics to happen in a host city are maybe more dubious. And I think that happens with FIFA too, that, the you know, it's this kind of maybe corruption or, you know, these exceptional states that can happen behind that are overlooked.
Yeah, I guess we should just make clear we're not accusing anyone of corruption here.
I know
what you mean in the sense that it feels that something epic is being pushed through. Can I ask you, what I thought was interesting reading the book is that, you know, I guess many outsiders think of this as having been a wasteland. And you hint at many other stories in the book, you know, from people using it as allotments to grow vegetables to the fact that there were many people whose homes were compulsory purchased, to businesses that were removed. Is there a kind of something to do with a kind of a loss of memory from that the land that you're concerned about documenting as well?
Yeah, because the idea of wasteland was used probably more in a derogatory term, that it's empty, it's kind of a blank on the map, and it literally did look a blank on the map in the A to Z, and now there's a new A to Z published, that there wasn't anything there to be destroyed. But there were obviously all these communities and businesses. And it was a dirty area. It was a former really industrial area. You know, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution was seated in that valley. So, you know, it did need in some ways a cleaning up. But that kind of total cleansing and these kind of Photoshop visions of the future, don't allow for a selective amnesia of the area, that it's kind of copy edited by the developers and choice bits of history might be allowed. But these kind of more dissenting voices are swept under the carpet.
And is the art of dissent, or is maybe the sense of loss and of documenting that loss. Is that a rich sort of seam for the artist that you work with and that you document in this book?
Yeah, it seems to be. We were careful. We didn't want it to become just a kind of act of nostalgia, because it is just about looking at kind of more alternative strategies of looking towards the future that could be more inclusive and grassroots. But yeah, it seems to be important, particularly in the photographer's work. And the book split into four sections that deal with incursions that deal with the kind of political economy of the event, then excavations and displacements, which are more about that. The lost communities and the kind of a love of the landscape as it was.
Do you think that people would be more willing to listen to you in a year's time, 18 months' time? Because I think what people in London haven't quite realised, in fact, the park kind of closes down for 2 years once the games are over.
Yeah, which is crazy, isn't it? You can't do anything in there.
No, and so you can't go on the orbital. It will be a shutdown ride. That many of the kind of the arenas need to be re-engineered for use outside of the games. And I wonder if that during that fallow period people will begin to wonder, actually, is this land being used in the best way?
Yeah, and it's hard to see at the moment, because it's so, legacy has always been this more nebulous concept, and particularly in terms of that, the kind of privatisation of that space and how it opens up and how bits are suddenly released to the public and kind of how a public might take ownership of that area again. It used to be like part of four boroughs, but now it's a whole new place to be created. So yeah, I wondered that about this kind of book, whether it was only of interest before the Olympics or hopefully it has that life and can continue to, well, we always, the book came out of this kind of discussions and gatherings of people, and we want to keep using it as a way of bringing people together to promote debate and ideas and to kind of carry on the discussion.
And did everyone that sort of had input in the book have quite similar ideas, or did you kind of have to argue everyone down just to find something that would fit in, 370 pages or whatever?
I
wonder if dissent is kind of like global as assent. Obviously, there are lots of people that disagreed with who should be sponsors of the Olympics or what should be involved. I wonder if dissent is similarly as universal.
I think that's the kind of the maybe the strength, but also the problem with the dissent of voices. Yeah, that everyone is different, and within the book, I mean, Isaac, my co-editor, was quoting, I think it's Mallarmé, to be together apart in dissent and allowing those different voices to happen, which is against the kind of consensus of the Olympics. But yeah, but that's also where sometimes, I mean, I'm not an activist or in the protest movement, but that's where that kind of dissent fails as well, because there isn't a movement that's growing against
the Judean People's Front versus the People's Front of Judea. We're back at the life of Brian.
And tell me, do you watch any of the Olympics? Did you feel guilty watching any of the Olympics?
No, that's a good question.
I don't feel guilty. Because I was in Scotland at the opening ceremony and I was dying to get back to watch the opening ceremony, and I was getting really emotional and I really liked it. So there is that contradictory element, and it's not that part of the Olympics that, I have a problem with. It's just that it's just such a massive, like, enchanting spell that other things get forgotten.
It's a spell that we're under, but I guess your book comes into its own, as Andrew says, kind of when the dust has settled and when everyone's gone back home, and then we'll see. And then the 2 year fallow period is when the art of dissent will come into its own. It'll be a set text for years to come, possibly.
Hopefully, yeah.
Hilary Powell, thank you so much for coming in and seeing us on the Monocle Weekly. We're going to have some music in a minute, Andrew. Can you wait?
I can. Just a moment, though.
All right. You're back with the 161st edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck. Hilary Powell, just saying, gave a very cogent she was a very cogent voice, wasn't she, for the Olympic descent, if you will.
Yes, because she wasn't kind of crazy about it. And that's what's so nice about the book, is it is a real kind of, subtle evocation. It's just interesting that, at a time like this, to have a voice that says anything questioning of the Games is very difficult. We're so caught up in national pride in this country that it's interesting her voice doesn't sound shrieking.
A subtlety with it as well, rather than just kind of going, I don't like McDonald's, I don't like the big brands.
Yeah.
Like someone saying, well, look at all the other stuff. Because there have been people that do it, but you're right, there's always a sense of ego about it. And we should tell the name of her book again, because it's self-published. The Art of Dissent, Adventures in London's Olympic State.
So I think if you go onto one of those googly kind of things, you'd find that, because she said that she has a website for selling the book, and it is available through some kind of bookshops in London, the smaller bookshops, for example.
But Falls is doing it.
Falls is doing it. Yeah. I think the Tate Modern Bookshop is carrying it as well.
Should we play some music now?
Please.
We're going to be vaguely current, and this is a big favourite of ours at Monocle, but I don't think Andrew and I have ever boogied down to it. So
I'm
we'll
up,
play
I'm
it
ready.
Now. I'll play it on the weekly. This is from Elton John's kind of teaming up with some of his mates from Australia, some of his super fans who've remixed a lot of his kind of classic mid-70s stuff. And this is called Good Morning to the Night, and it's Elton John and Pnau. And that was Elton John and Pnau with Good Morning to the Night. That's good fizzy stuff, right?
I'm ready for running. I'm ready to go. I'm Olympic'd up.
I'm ready for a night out after that. Sounds like the good stuff. Our next guest is Charles Atlas, a director whose work has encompassed film, video and dance. His career started on Super 8 in 1978, and since then he's directed more than 80 films, working with such luminaries as the American choreographer Merce Cunningham, the dance scenes Enfant Terrible, Michael Clarke, and not least with the late Lee Bowery. He's currently in London for the Meltdown Festival at the South Bank Centre, curated by one of his current collaborators, Anthony Hegarty, also known as Anthony the Johnsons. Charles, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi.
That was quite a wordy introduction, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite good. It's quite nice. I think Charles was sitting there kind of going, yeah, I have done all that. And he was ticking it off a little list he has in front of him. You're here in London right now for Meltdown, which has got very good, which in London has a great reputation. It's always the sort of like kind of left-leaning, more interesting side of these kind of national kind of arts festivals. Mm-hmm. Can tell us about your collaboration with Anthony Hegarty, who's a Sussex-born New Yorker.
Yes. Well, I've known Anthony since the 90s, and we collaborated eventually after having known each other for 10 years or so. We made a live piece together where I did live video accompanying with the band and his music. And we made we recorded on the version that we did on tour in Europe in 2006, and then combined that with other material to make this film that we're premiering.
And it's got kind of a little bit of a tough it's got a bit of natural competition in London at the moment. We've got some amazing gymnastics going on.
Yes.
I've got to get my Olympics question in before we start talking about your work in greater detail. Have you been watching that with interest, or have you been thinking, I'll give them straight sixes.
I was in New York for the opening ceremony, and I actually watched it on the BBC because I have a little thing on my computer which allows me to do that. And it was great. I loved it. But then I saw it on NBC, on the American, and they put commercials.
Everything's all wrong. All the timing's all wrong. Right?
Yeah.
On NBC.
Terrible.
Yeah. Okay. So the choreography is better on the BBC.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I've seen the. I was transfixed by watching the ping pong. It's brutal.
it's brutal, and you know that actually for the ping pong, that's not at the Olympic Center at all. That's actually just in someone's garage. You know that. It's just a big set.
And Charles, can I ask you, when Rob was introducing all these kind of amazing people that you've collaborated with, there's some strong characters in there, and some people have kind of very willful ideas about what they wanted to get out of life. Mm-hmm. And thinking about Lee Bowery, who I interviewed many years ago. I think he knew what he wanted to do on a daily basis. Was it hard to use that term, collaborate, with him?
No, not at all. I mean, he was my best friend, so it was pretty easy. And the things I did with him normally is when he came over to New York.
And but with all of these people, with Michael Clarke, all these people, what allows somebody, these people with clear visions, big egos, and they come to work with you. How do you get around that? How do you begin to make them kind of work in conjunction with you? Or do you think they're actually naturally collaborative people anyway?
I've had very good fortune. And I started out with Merce Cunningham, so that's sort of the... and that was a very... It's starting at the top, in a way. And he's sort of the gold standard of collaboration because he had a very open way of collaborating. And because of his work with John Cage and Bob Rauschenberg, and had good luck with letting everyone have lots of room and then combining it. And so that's the way I've worked. And the people who I've sought out and who've sought me out, we kind more or less worked that way.
And I wanted to ask you, after I've just done a stage cough almost, I could get a part. I wanted to talk about also that element of collaboration. When your fingers are in so many pies and the set design, the lighting and all the rest of it, do people kind of come to you for the look? They have an idea that they need to be translated. I'd like to talk maybe about Anthony, who we obviously know. We know is a sort of obviously has talents in more than one direction, but I kind of, you know, he's obviously well known as an amazing voice. Do you, you know, are you able to bring stuff out of a performer?
Well, it's not quite like that. It's really like it's sort of a mysterious process, and it's a little bit different with everyone.
I want you to do a gesture with that. I want it to be like a taking a rabbit out of a hat gesture.
And with Anthony, Anthony's a very particular kind of artist and has a really strong vision. And I'm able somehow to find my way into these various visions and also keep my own identity. So, and it's partly the, you know, the goodwill on everyone's part. I mean, I've had a few kind of collaborations that haven't worked, but mostly I've worked with certain people over and over, and it has worked. So that's what I keep doing.
And do you need to care about the story? I mean, for this new project with that, and do you need to care about the story so much, or is it? I mean,
there are two different things. There was a stage production, which was one thing, and then this the film, which was using that material for a whole different work of art in a way. So there was much more of a story in the film than there was in the stage production.
Yeah, no, because I was talking about the film, and I guess they are kind of different things. And they've got a different narrative strength, a different pull, I guess.
Because in the, you know, the film and the stage production was based around 13 women, one who was for each song, one represented each song. And on stage, you only saw them. And you saw their image, and you saw my portraits of them, but in the film we interview them, and you get a much more personal take on who they are.
So you get to hear them in their own words, rather than them being sort of their spirit being imbued by the different music or the way that you direct them and choreograph them, I guess.
And Charles, back in the very beginning of your career, when you did work with Merce Cunningham for so many years, and you were in-house filmmaker with Merce Cunningham and the company. Did you start off as a filmmaker? Or did you start off as an artist? How did you enter that world of dance?
I started out as an assistant stage manager, but I was already a filmmaker. I was making Super 8 films already at that time, and I got hired as assistant stage manager when I was like in my early 20s. And my first job was blowing up Andy Warhol's silver pillows with helium to go on stage. and
I was hoping you'd say something like that.
And then eventually when Merce decided he wanted to make video, he asked me to collaborate with him, and I didn't. I only knew film, so I learned video from a book, and then I taught it to him, basically.
Wow, and just tell me that beginning with, you know, you referenced Andy Warhol there. That was that the kind of generation of filmmakers that began to inspire you in the early days as well?
Andy Warhol is definitely one of my big influences as a filmmaker. I was already a film buff. I went to movies all the time, so I wasn't really a video person, because I thought people who were working.
But again, he's kind of I guess he did many things that kind of broke down the barriers between what was performance and what was film. And did that kind of little revolution that he was part of really inform your work then?
Well, the big influence was really Bob Rauschenberg for me as an artist. The people who were my heroes when I was 20 were the only ones who ever lasted as heroes.
You still don't. You don't still want to be an astronaut,
right?
I wonder if I'll say that seems like such a scene. That was such a scene. Mm-hmm. How does it feel different now? I mean, do you feel when you work with someone like Anthony Hegarty, do you feel that there's a scene? There are different scenes that you're tapping into, or does it feel a little bit more like an open playing field now? there are less kind of genre specific things. You don't define yourself in the same way you might have done back then.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's really like being, you know, being part of a lot of different families.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I'm part of the Michael Clark family. I'm part of the Anthony family, and so far those things don't clash.
And can we ask you the obvious question, which I'm sure you've been asked hundreds of times before, but the name Charles Atlas?
It's my real name.
It's your real name?
It always comes up when someone else is buying me a plane ticket, and they say, so, is that your real name?
That's very good. But do people get a bit confused occasionally?
When I was growing up, it was a hard name to grow up with, but I find... there's almost coming up to be a generation who never heard of the other guy, so.
Yeah, well, that's right. I guess you're right. Kind of...
But still, most people have.
And also, I've got to ask you, you should tell our listeners that you've got, you're wearing an orange T-shirt, an orange hoodie, and you've got orange sideburns.
Mm-hmm.
Are you supporting the Dutch?
No, I try not to go to Holland because otherwise I'm mistaken for a football fan.
You wouldn't be allowed to leave if you got there, you know, that's the problem. Charles Atlas, thank you so much for coming into the Monocle Weekly and telling us about your new stuff with Anthony Hegarty and about all those questions we had to ask you. Okay. Thank you so much for coming.
Okay, thank you.
I quite enjoyed that show. What do you think of the new section, the news roundup, news beat?
I thought it was good.
Mm.
I quite liked the fact that
you sold Sophie short. Slightly. I've seen you as a short slightly by saying that she can't ever wait to get her clothes on. But anyway, I'm sure she'll be. You know, I'm sure.
Do you think she's going to be waiting outside the studio when I leave?
I think industrial tribunals aren't what they used to be, Andrew. I think it's going to be fine.
I'll just get a bucket of water out and you'll have that kind of Pavlovian response. Yeah. I'll be fine. I'll be able to
exactly.
run away.
Jump in it.
Yes.
That was the 161st Monocle Weekly. I haven't presented a show with you for a while since the Midori House we did. I mean, that was obviously only about 6 days ago. But a Monocle Weekly, I like this. This is a good format.
Yes, I think we should do this more often.
Hooray.
It's like the old days.
It is like the olden days. Like the olden days, cool. They want their show back.
Yes.
So that's all from the Weekly, I think, Andrew.
Good. Well, I think we've done a good show. I'm very happy. I'm going to tick that one off.
What's happening for the rest of your Sunday?
The rest of my Sunday is... Actually, I've got friends here. I'm looking after them.
Okay.
They've been on holiday around the world and they've landed in London for a couple of days.
After all that, they're definitely looking after poor things. This show was produced by Paul Noble. The research was Tom Hall. We can tick those off. They booked the guests. They were good. Charles Atlas.
Yeah, they did quite well.
I wanted to uncork some wine and tell me all about all the...
Well, we can do that afterwards and I'll tell you about my life instead.
All right, cool. We'll be back same time next week. But for now, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.